Young entertainment professionals.
The best thing about what I do is the people. Period. The music is great, and I love that I get to play guitar and make music. But the people, the community we have here in Nashville, all the players, all the writers, the producers, the production assistants, the pluggers, the label people, A&R. I mean, there's just so many great people we get to be around and hang around. You know, I'm going to a roast of Shane McAnally here in a minute, you know, and it's definitely the people is the best thing about what I do.
Welcome to the Young Entertainment Professionals Podcast, a series featuring the people cultivating the entertainment industry and their tie with YEP Nashville. Today's guest stumbled upon his role in entertainment. While his parents were well ingrained in the industry, he did not choose music as a career path until he joined a band for fun. Session musician and producer Derek Wells is with us, and he is also one of the founders of our YEP Rewind shows that happen quarterly at the Basement East. We have a show coming up later in the year, and we will be releasing info on that very, very soon. Derek has worked with household names like Dolly Parton, Steven Tyler, and Josh Turner, and his most recent project involved producing Maren Morris's latest album, Girl. This is a great episode about navigating industry relationships as it pertains to client projects, preparing for an audition, and why a well-crafted song is the foundation of the creative process. Now to our episode with Derek Wells. Welcome, Derek Wells, to the Young Entertainment Professionals Podcast.
I'm happy to be here.
It's a mouthful.
It is.
How's it going?
It's great. How about yourself?
Yeah, really good. It's been a busy week.
Yes.
In country music and just in general.
Yeah, okay. I'll take it. Yeah.
Yeah. So from the interviews that I've listened to and what I've read about you, music did not come as an interest early on. It came on later. So can you talk a little bit about that and share with us your experience?
Yeah. A common story I hear in this town, you actually said something similar when we were talking earlier, is that, my parents just loved music, and I grew up in a house, and my dad used to play old Johnny Cash records, or we listened to old Beatles records and that kind of stuff. And that was just not my house growing up. You know, when I was, born, my parents wanted to be musicians, and they kind of existed in the sideman world, if you will, my dad being a guitar player and my mother being a singer and piano player. And when we had music playing at the house, it was stuff that they had to do for work. You know, it was like sometimes not so great songs that they were charting or music that they had to learn for some sort of show or gig or something. And some of it was cool, but it was in my home, music was definitely like the job, you know, and we didn't really listen to music, in terms of an extracurricular, and around our house. So, in fact, it was kind of isolated to the music room where my parents would go work on, songs and stuff. And so I think just a combination of that and then just situationally growing up, none of my friends really were interested in it. I didn't have any buddies that were in bands or anything like that. And so, the bug just really didn't hit me until my late teens a cousin play drums and he wanted to play music and be in a band, whatever that meant, which at that stage in your life, being in a band means you kind of go to your uncle's basement and hack around.
Right.
We weren't playing
gigs. It wasn't for real. You were just doing it for fun.
So not for real. Yeah. And, that was kind of the seed where everything started. And I just literally chose guitar because we had them laying around the house.
That's
it was
so
like
funny.
My dad's a guitar player, and so it was like, hey, can I borrow one of your guitars? Yeah, sure. That was kind of how it all started.
So since it wasn't something that you early on wanted to pursue, so when it became something you wanted to pursue, was there ever that pressure of
immense? Yeah, the thing I tell people a lot is that everyone in Nashville, whether it's a songwriter or a singer or a guitar player or, what have you, artist, they were the best one in the little town they're from or the, big town sometimes. Mm-hmm. And, that was certainly the case for my parents. They moved from Arkansas and my dad was the best guitar player anybody around there had ever seen. And my mom was the best singer a lot of people have to make the move here to Nashville and then kind of get the reality check that the bar is much, 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 much higher than it was where you were from. And, the reality is that unless you live in Nashville and then arguably LA, you know, you're basing your skill level and your talent on a thing that's not really in reality, right?
Yeah.
So where I was really lucky, but what was also terrifying is that I had a very real understanding immediately of what the bar was to be a guitar player. So, which was kind of my, you know, jump off point for me. It was like, well, I'm going to play guitar. And when I made that decision and, you know, I was not going to do college anymore and I'm going to just move back home and live in my dad's basement and try to play mm-hmm. guitar, I wasn't even trying to tell people that I played guitar or try to go play with somebody, or I knew I wasn't good enough. I was going to go embarrass myself. You know, I knew how good my parents were and their peers and the people I had grown up to admire. And I thought I could be that good someday. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to be that good, but I knew I wasn't. And, you know, I certainly didn't want to go out and, you know, embarrass myself or embarrass them or any of those things. So, you know, it was a solid, you know, 18 months of, you know, waiting tables and woodshedding in the basement before I even, you know, thought about going out and playing music with somebody.
Do you think that helped you in a sense that you didn't have a false idea of what it was like to be a session musician?
100%. Yeah. Yeah. It helped in all kind of stages. But basically, just knowing that, well, like I said, knowing where the bar is mm-hmm. and knowing how serious they took it. And also, I'd say this, knowing what it's like to be, you know, basically an outsider being hired to do a job as it relates to music. Because
right.
again, a lot of people come to town and they're used to being in bands, or they're an artist and their band was their buddies. And the dynamic of those relationships is not the same as somebody who's saying, I'm going to pay you money to show up and play guitar or play bass or sing harmonies or whatever. And you have to approach it like a job. You know, you can't
yeah.
get too comfortable just because, you know, the money isn't some icing on the cake thing. It's like you're there to do a service, you know, to render payment, basically. So knowing that, I think, helped me walking into things.
So when you've walked into a project, how do you kind of create boundaries in the sense where you don't get too emotionally attached to that project, but enough to contribute to the creativity of it and the vision?
Right. And that's the needle, right? That's the needle you have to thread all the time, because, you know, it's easy to not get wrapped up in it if you just didn't care. Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you look at it in this from this kind of transactional sense of, like, you know, sessions, you know, here in Nashville, we kind of run these sessions on, you know, the 3-hour blocks kind of per our union. And it's like, yeah, it would be easy to just show up and say, you got me from 10 to 1. I'll do whatever and not really care and just kind of do the thing, or maybe phone it in or maybe not, but not pour yourself into it. Right. The flip side of that is caring too much and possibly forgetting that, again, we're in a service industry.
Mm-hmm.
Again, caring maybe too much and starting to lose sight of, like, well, I do kind of have a boss here. You know, I'm not going to tell the songwriter who hired me for a demo that, like, their idea is terrible.
Right.
And that, like, no, that's wrong. You should do it like this. You know, there are moments when I can kind of maybe politely suggest an alternative in times, or something that I think is maybe an improvement in a take it or leave it. And then that same thing kind of just only grows when you talk about records and projects that can span out, you know, the work of those things and the scope of those things are larger on the front end and the back end. They take longer to make.
Mm-hmm.
So you're more involved. And then the, you know, concept or in the prospect of it blowing up and being this long-term thing that you might have to hear or might get to hear for a long time. How do you give yourself to that project and really care about it and really care about what you're contributing, and also kind of retain this service industry mentality, right? You know, that is always, that's the needle I'm trying to thread every day as a session player and as a producer, right? And so I wish I could say I nailed it every day. There's been days when I fall on either side of that line, but I'm always trying to show up and take, you know, the song or the music or the project that I'm given and say, okay, how can I make this the best song for this writer? Like, how can I help them get their vision on paper? How can I make, you know, if I'm producing a Scotty McCreery record, how can I make the best Scotty record? It's not how can I make a record for me and, you know, get all my kicks on every choice at the end of the day, you know? So that's the needle I'm always trying to thread every day. And it's a battle, you know?
I'm sure. And I mean, you probably don't even know, you can't plan too far ahead because albums and projects change all the time and songs change all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So before I go through, a list of people that you worked with and talking about, you know, those experiences, I want to know how you prioritize those different projects. What is that just like a hefty, like,
oh, it's the worst.
Ambiguous question.
It's tough. It is, you know, as someone, you know, it's a tricky question to answer because, you know, there's a lot of terms for this, you know, king's problems or what have you. And it's like, this stuff only becomes an issue once you get kind of busy and you get to maybe a certain level of success. And so you feel it's hard to complain about these sort of things, but the greatest challenge I have is what you're talking about. And that's how to prioritize art, right? Because on the one hand, you know, a songwriter's demo session to that songwriter can probably feel as important as a record that I'm going to play on for somebody. You know, the songs are their life. They've poured their heart into those things. You know, this is their job. This is their career. They're hoping to get these songs recorded in a way that can elevate the songs and then ultimately their career and all these kinds of things. But the scope of some of the bigger records and stuff is kind of undeniable to an extent. So the most common thing I see is kind of having to wrangle how I schedule and how I allot time for the songwriters and the demo sessions versus when the records call, because there's plenty of times when I have to call someone and say, hey, Steve Bogard, I know we had this demo session booked for Thursday the 22nd, and I know you booked me like 3 weeks ago, but Kenny Chesney needs to record for 3 days and I can't miss Kenny Records. Like, these are things I have to be a part of for a lot of reasons. And so
that would be a Bart all call.
Incredible.
We'll just want to let that be on here.
We should, because I think it was too legit to quit too. I may be wrong, but I think that's what the song that was playing.
Josh, could you hear what song that was?
No. I think it was too legit to quit. Anywho, so yeah, but back to the scheduling thing. That's part of the thing I'm having to do. And then you take a stair step on top of that. It becomes when you get a call about a Tim McGraw record, but you're already booked on a Thomas Rhett record, and having to kind of figure out how to, well,
it's pretty tough to decide which. Yeah.
Well, yeah. And it's rarely to never, I can just tell you this for me, I adopted pretty early on just a standing policy of like first come, first serve. And so everyone knows, you know, I kind of famously turned down Steven Tyler from Aerosmith the first time I got a call to go do a session for him because I was already booked. And I was already booked for someone that was definitely not of the scope of that artist of, you know, Steven Tyler or Aerosmith, but that's the way I do it. And what that helps me is when, you know, someone does call and they say, well, man, we need you. And I go, well, look, the last time this was turned around and I was telling somebody else I couldn't do it, or we couldn't do that day, or I couldn't be there because I was being loyal to you. So you have to understand that this is how this goes, you know? So that's been my kind of thing. Certainly different people have different ways of handling that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's always worked out in the end. Okay. And ultimately, you know, Steven Tyler, for example, I didn't do that session, but they cut some more and I was invited to be there the next part. And they couldn't fault me for holding to a commitment that I'd already had, you know.
It just shows, like you said, the loyalty and humility and being in this business and just trusting that what opportunities come along that are for you. And
I believe that. I believe that, you know, look, no one can be everywhere all the time. No. And in those seasons where you are busy, all you can do is try to honor commitments and try to handle all those things with grace and positivity to people and just show them that you're not, you know, thinking about any of it frivolously, basically.
You end up investing in those relationships with a genuine foot forward.
Completely.
And then, you know, more things come along and you know, don't miss out as people think they will, you know?
Absolutely. That has absolutely been my experience in the business. Yeah.
I love it. So I'm going to read out a short list from a huge list of people that you've worked with. Can you describe in 1 to 2 words that describe their work ethic or stylistically how they approach a recording session?
Okay.
Dolly Parton, to start with her.
Queen, pro. Dolly wakes up at 5 a.m. every day to this day and works really hard until about 5:30 or 6, and then she shuts it down. And when she's in recording sessions, she's engaged. Mm-hmm. She's focused. You know, she's not on a cell phone. I mean, she doesn't even have one, but she's very present. Contributes in a way that's not elitist at all, will listen to anyone's ideas, willing to try anything, but also is able to simultaneously stay true and be completely herself. She is the definition of professional, and it's absolutely no secret why she is where she is.
Lucy Silvis.
Oh my God. Beloved. It's the first one. And singular. Lucy is one of those, to me, artists that you could go 100 years and not find another Lucy Silvis. She just has such a unique viewpoint. She's one that I always just go like, I wonder what music Lucy listens to when she's hanging out.
Right?
'Cause she comes in and plays these songs, and it's just this unbelievable combination of you know, influences that, you know, obviously there's a lot of British stuff, but then there's these kind of core like American soul things to her, and lyrically it's diverse but also really poignant, and her singing is just incredible.
World.
I can't say enough good things about her. Definitely one of the easier, her last record was definitely one of the easier records I've been a part of in terms of feeling creative, because you hear a song and it just inspires you.
Thomas Rhett.
TR, fun, a great guy, and also professional. TR is you know, he cares a lot. He thinks so much. He puts so much time and energy into the kind of songs he's writing, the kind of songs he's cutting, the things he wants to say, and how that it will be translated, you know, to an audience. And those are definitely some of the most, we have a blast on those sessions. The music's always fun, and TR again is really engaged, and that's a good crew. And that the whole production combination on those records, Jesse Fraser, Dan Huff, and also Julian Benetez, we have a blast.
All great people.
Yeah.
Kenny Chesney.
Kenny, man, I mean, you know, icon. Someone said this. I'll steal someone else's words, but they said, you know, Kenny is his audience and his audience is him. And that is a
so
guy.
True.
Well, man, he is dialed in to what his fans want to hear, mm-hmm. to a level that I don't know that I've seen in other artists. And I mean, certainly, you know, people connect with their fans in a lot of different ways. But when he talked about his live show, or when he talks about the kind of songs he wants to record and we cut those things, and he knows what his fans want from him, what the kind of songs they want to hear him sing, and how it's going to go over in terms of his, you know, massive stadium show, because he's been doing it so long. So he is his audience, and his audience is him.
Steven Tyler.
I mean, yeah, legend. And I mean, that voice, it was, you know, I remember tracking the first song of that thing, and he was blown away that we hadn't heard the song when we got there. That was pretty funny.
That's hilarious.
And we had this really interesting moment where me and the bass player, Twin Studio, Steven's like, you guys haven't heard the song? Here, take my phone. And he just kind of shoves his cell phone, which was also his wallet with all his, you know, credit cards and everything. He's like, go out in the hall.
One of those like sticky, like back pocket.
Totally.
Thing, yeah.
Like, go out in the hall and listen to this. And we're like holding Steven. We've been there 5 minutes. I'm holding Steven Tyler's phone, listening to this song. And he was definitely, when I heard his voice come through the headphones the first time, that was one of the more surreal musical experiences I've ever had, for sure.
And then Maren Morris.
God.
Because I also want to talk about her new album in a second, but
First word that comes to mind with Maren is artist. And you know, I met Maren really early on, when she was doing a New Faces night at the old basement. And we had some mutual friends from Texas, and I was lucky enough to play on, you know, Maren's first demo session in Nashville, and was obviously part of her first record, and now, and we've been friends, and then, you know, she's now married to one of my good friends. Ryan's a good buddy. And you know, Maren has just always been special. She is, and she again has a very unique viewpoint and has a thing stylistically that is just undeniably her. And it's amazing how, you know, we can take some of these songs, and if you kind of looked at them as separate pieces or you had different person's voice on them, some of them might at first glance not seem to go together, but then you get her singing on it and you get her take on it, and suddenly it just all becomes this thing, and it's amazing. You know, she's special.
So how did her latest album come together? Like, what was that process like with her? I mean, it's beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Visually and...
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Well, you know, it was quite different from the first record, because the first record, you know, a lot of people don't realize, we made... About half of that first record was made before Maren even had a record deal. You know, I recorded a lot of the guitars, well, I mean, all the guitars, for songs like My Church and 80s Mercedes and I Could Use a Love Song in the my old condo, you know. And her producer at the time, Busby, they were writing a lot of great songs, and we were kind of just email exchanging a lot of the music, because it was, we didn't realize the scale, you know. They were demos for at that time, for all intents and purposes, that just became, you know, records, and obviously became kind of special recordings. So the new record, it was great because, you know, Maren had obviously a lot of kind of leverage, and I hate to use the word leverage, but you get you get to make some choices once you've won a Grammy and, you know, you've had a successful album and all that kind of stuff. And so it was great. You know, we holed up at a studio. It was a year ago in May, so May of 2018. And we were there a couple weeks, and her producer, Busby, and myself, and Aaron Sterling plays drums, who plays for John Mayer, and he was a big part of the first record too. And that's the band for Maren, you know. And I remember myself, you know, completely put on to myself, feeling a lot of pressure going into the recording, thinking, man, you know, she won a Grammy and we've done this, and I'm really proud of that first record and it's been really successful for her, and like, I want this next one to be great or better, or the next logical step in evolution for Maren. And even though, you know, she didn't put any of that pressure on me, you know, that's because she never would, but that's how I was approaching it. And you know, the first song she played us, we were like, okay, this is all going to be fine.
This is going to be great.
Here's Maren. She's here to save the day. She showed up with a bunch of great songs.
What was the first song she played you?
The first song that I heard, I think the first song we recorded was Gold Love. She had written that with Busby, and that was the first one I'd heard for the new record. And I thought, okay, we're gonna be fine. And then of course, it all just keeps coming. You know, it's like just really great. You know, like great song after great song after great song after great song. And every time we'd get through one, we'd be like, oh my god, it's been one of those days. That was my phone that time, guys. Playing, hold on, Karate Chop remix, whatever that is. That's what my phone just played. And so, yeah, and then from then on out, you know, Maren in the studio, like, her voice is also, you know,
incredible,
and it's inspiring too. You know, a lot of people don't realize, you know, as a player, what we gain out of, you know, someone really performing a vocal when we're recording this music. It really does affect us and translate. And that's another thing you get with Maren is just, you know, top-notch singing, and the songwriting's great. And she's always committed to doing stuff that's cool and pushing it, but also having a viewpoint. So yeah, we just kind of hold up until that record was done. And it's been, I did a few overdub things after the initial, you know, couple weeks of tracking, but then it was hard for me because I went like 8 months without hearing the record, you know?
Yeah.
Until he finally started to get mixes back, and she shared a couple and her producer shared a couple. And I was like, then it got me fired up again. I was like, we're actually releasing this. It's a great record. Yeah.
Other people are going
to
hear it.
Yeah. But Maren's, she's a joy to work for, and as is Busby, the producer. And that's a special record for me. Both of those records are special to me.
So whether it be a songwriter or an artist that you're working with, how can they best prepare for a session? Kind of going off what you were saying about an artist, you know, preparing well for a vocal, like,
mm-hmm. Well,
you know,
there's a couple things. And I think I'd be lying if I said it was the exact same if you're a songwriter or if you're an artist, because I do think there's some differences there. Mm-hmm. If you're a songwriter preparing for a session, you know, most of the time we're going to be taking some sort of really bare bones version of the song and kind of trying mm-hmm. to build it up, right? And so, and this sounds funny, but I always say, you know, the best thing, you can do for your songs in terms of being prepared for a demo session is have the song finished. A lot of times, you know, we get into these demo sessions for songwriters and there's sections that they're unsure about, or they're still tweaking this part of it. And then that kind of comes up for debate. And sometimes you make decisions that, in the moment, that even well-intentioned can be wrong, or wrong for the song. Not to mention, you know, you created new problems for the musicians to solve that they don't really need to be solving. You know what I mean? It's like, so I always say the way it works best is that you bring this piece of music and it inspires me to go play something that then hopefully elevates the song, right?
Right.
But if you bring in this thing and it's kind of patchworked and not really...
Not a clear vision.
And you also don't know, you can't offer any insight, you know, into where we need to go. You can't point me in a direction. Well, then I end up having to solve all these problems before I even start playing guitar, right? Kind of on an intellectual thing. Mm-hmm. And you're just not going to get the best product, you know? So I would say in terms of songwriters, the best thing they can do when they show up to sessions is, have an accurate, you know, representation of the song. If you're not the kind of person who can come in and play the song once without messing up for the band so that we can learn it or chart mm-hmm. it, make sure you have at least one decent iPhone recording of the song without mistakes, and where we can hear the chords and where we can hear the voice and all that kind of stuff. Because I can't tell you how many times we've gotten work tapes and it's recorded poorly. You know, the phone is 3 inches from the person's face and the guitar's way down here and we can't hear any of the chords. And they're like, well, that wasn't me playing guitar. That was my friend. Well, can you show me the chords? No. Can you not hear them? No, we can't, you know. And
because they may hear them in their head, but that's hard to translate to you.
And
yeah, right.
And so, and that's the kind of stuff. So in terms of preparation for songwriter demos, just having a clear, basic, no frills recording of the song, you know, that we can hear and we can chart from. Mm. And again, being familiar enough with the song where you can answer questions or follow along when we start asking you things about,
right.
Hey, the bridge of this song, hold on, what part is that? What is that song? You know, and that kind of stuff. It can get, you know, it can just bog everything down and you're not going to get the best product at the end. For artists, a lot of times those sessions, there's already some sort of mocked up version of the song, maybe not, but usually there is. And we also have a lot more time. Mm-hmm. We have a lot more time to chase down things, to try stuff. And the great thing about the artist sessions too is that 9 times out of 10, they're going to be like kind of the North Star for us all. You know, they're going to go, you know, no, I don't love that. We need to make it more like this and really be able to explain it. So for artists, in terms of being prepared, I would say, again, it's just kind of like know your song and have the vision for where you want to go, and everything else should take care of itself.
Great tips. So what is it like working with new artists that you haven't known for a long time, like Marin?
Right.
And I don't know when you met, you know, Abby Anderson, Daniel Bradbury, et cetera, sure. Dan and Shay.
Yeah.
But what is it like entering into a project fresh, getting to know them, getting to know their style, getting to know yeah. the songs? Like,
it's a good question. That's a good question. And it's different every time. And so this kind of falls under the things you can control versus things you can't control, right? Mm-hmm. And so anytime I'm working for someone like that for the first time, hopefully, if you have a good producer, they're usually able to give you some sort of insight before you've even played a note about, hey, this guy's pretty traditional, or like, hey, this girl mm-hmm. loves this kind of stuff. And I'm luckily enough in a situation now where sometimes they can even reference things that I've done. They can say, hey, they love the Marin record, just so you know. So like those kinds of sounds and tones. We're not here to make a copycat record, but like,
right.
Okay, great. Okay. So that helps. But if you really don't know anything, at the core, all I can do is hear a song, walk out there and do what I think is right, you know? And so it really boils down to instinct. Now, at that point, once I've kind of thrown an option out there, we've played the song once or twice and the band and me have kind of, this is what we're doing instinctively. Best case scenario, they love it. They say you're on the right direction and you can tweak from there. Worst case scenario, they go, this is really not it. You know, this is, it doesn't feel right and it's not. And and that's where, again, the service industry part of it comes in. Mm-hmm. Because by going out there and playing what's in my gut, I've kind of said without saying, like, well, I think this is cool, right?
Right.
And so when they go, this is not it, you can't get offended. You have to just kind of go, okay, that's all right. I kind of aimed wrong here, or they have a different vision for this. So you start asking some questions and you start trying to feel out some references. If you're lucky, they're very articulate and they can say, man, we don't want it to be as big or as bombastic. Like it doesn't have to rock so hard. We can make it a little smaller or intimate. And those can inform choices. Sometimes they say, man, I don't really know where to start or what to say, but this is definitely not it. And they're entitled to say that, you know?
Yeah.
So we have to get into the business of interpreter, you know, and you try to figure out. And you build that relationship brick by brick by brick of like little victory after little victory. You know, every time I do something that they seem to like, or I'm able to find out what they're trying to say, mm-hmm. we're building a little bit of trust. And it's also helping me develop and sharpen the scope of where we're going to aim these records. You know, and then, you know, hopefully you get an album in, two albums in, and you usually are pretty dialed in terms of, you know, speaking the same language, you know,
right.
And it's like, not that we're at all interested in making the same album over and over and over, but there are things you can learn and things that you realize people gravitate to and that they want to hear when they play you a rough recording, the things that they want to respond to, you know? So yeah, there's no simple answer and there's no quick answer to all that. It's like dating somebody.
Yeah.
You know, you show up.
I mean, have you ever stepped away from a project before?
I have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
rare occasion, I guess.
Yeah. I'll rephrase this. I've never stepped away mid project.
Okay.
But there have been a couple artists that, when the next project came around, I kind of politely declined and just said I was busy because I just didn't feel like I fit in that system. Mm-hmm. And you can argue like, well, they asked you back. You obviously fit. It's like, well, yeah, but it also kind of felt like it was harder than it should have been.
Forced.
Yeah.
And if there's something else that's on the line of where you fit, feel like you
exactly.
would rather invest your time. Than-
and that's, and like we're talking about too, is it's like, well, it's one thing to say like, well, yeah, they're going to pay you. I mean, gosh, I can't believe you would turn down blah, blah, go there. And it's like, well, yeah, but what if I ended up having to miss a thing that I really wanted to do because I was there doing this thing that I don't love and I don't really love the end product. And I wasn't, that was the other thing. I remember one of those specifically at the end of the day, I just wasn't proud of it when it was done. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, I don't love this. I'm not really proud of it. And I find it hard to believe that I'll be able to pour much of myself into the next one. So I'd rather not be there. It does happen. It's sometimes, you know, they're all blind dates. If it goes well, and
great.
You have a rapport, things build and you keep dating. But there are times you show up and you go, this did not go well. And the other one's going, hey, you want to go out again? Like, nope.
No, sorry.
No,
I can't.
Thanks. Yeah.
Busy. What drew you to playing on records full time?
Well, that comes at a base level. That came from my parents, specifically my dad. You know, he just, when I was young, and he was touring at the time, and he's playing for Reba, and he just held a lot of those guys in such high regard. Mm-hmm. It was just before I really cared about music. He talked about the session guys like they were the Yankees or the, you know, whatever, the Patriot, you know, whoever, whatever sports analogy you want to use. And so a lot of his kind of reverence to those guys and his kind of, you know, the regard he held those dudes and him getting excited about talking about them
right.
made me excited about it. And so pretty early on, I realized, man, those are the, you know, those are the baddest guys walking. And again, when I was going to play music, you know, I knew that I had a way better chance of getting a job touring first than trying to get in the session thing, because I didn't feel like I had the skill set yet. I was mm-hmm. still new to the instrument and I was still learning. And that ended up being my path. You know, I kind of came through the touring thing first and then ultimately made the decision, to switch, you know, or try to, not switch is a bad word, but try to make a concerted effort to stay here and just do recording.
Right.
But it was just kind of all based on this kind of childlike thing that I've always had about the guys making the records are just the greatest. You know, mm-hmm. they're just the most talented. Everyone wants to be those guys, you know.
I'm sure it was cool, you know, to start out in the touring with like Josh Turner,
exactly.
for example.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You got to hear that record live.
Yes.
So you got to see people's reactions. And mm-hmm. I'm sure that's played a huge role in
yep.
and your creative process.
Absolutely. And those were master classes for me too, in terms of learning how to be a session guitar player, because I would, you know, have to learn those records cover to cover. Every time Josh would have a new album cycle and I wasn't playing on the records in the early mm-hmm. days, I had to go through and learn all these session guys' guitar parts. And it was, you know, really great. And that stuff that I learned tricks from learning those records that I still use every day, you know, so.
So what do songs mean to you, either as a business person yeah. or as the listener?
Ooh. Well,
how do they inspire you?
Yeah, well, it's basically the same thing. I mean, I'm not a songwriter. And so for one, talk about reverence. Like, I just think it's amazing that people like Tom Douglas can walk in a room and, you know, or Laurie McKenna or whoever, and have nothing, have a blank sheet of paper, and just come up with this stuff and these amazing, you know, things that are moving, and then also, you know, they say things that people aren't able to say themselves, or they mm-hmm. say things in this universal way that's just relates to so many people on so many levels, or, you know, and it really is a universal language in that regards. And so I've always just been kind of blown away that people can do it at that level, for one.
Right.
And, you know, that to me is the basis of being a guitar player, a producer. It's like I said earlier, like when I hear these things, you know, these great songs, it's like that inspires me to then go do what I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I've said for years, my ability to play guitar is directly related to how good a song is. You know, I've never had trouble coming up with something when I thought the song was great.
Yeah.
You know, and the times when I'm usually like beating my head against the wall going, man, why is this not? Ultimately, at the end of the day, you know, subjectively, I've thought, oh, this, I don't really love this song, you know? And so, for me, I can't do what I do without songwriters, plain and simple. You know, I play guitar because I loved playing songs. That was always I don't play guitar to listen to myself rattle. You know, I like playing songs. And, so business and personally, it's like, they're everything to me, because when I listen casually at my house and put on a turntable, it's like, I love hearing songs and I love the idea that these people created this out of nothing. And as a producer and as a guitar player, I'm like, I wouldn't have a job without you guys.
And you get to add on to that, which is really cool.
It's the crayon analogy. It's like someone comes in and they have this, you know, great picture of the, John Mayer said this, like, it's like they've got a great picture and they had 16 colors, right? And the picture's already great, but I've got like a 64 box of crayons and I'm able to kind of go, oh, yes. This could use these three colors that you just didn't happen to have. And I can help there. And it's like, it's a win-win, but it's inspiring for me, you know?
Do you watch his current mood?
Oh yeah. All the time.
Sometimes I have on the background while I'm working.
Yes. Yes.
It's just, the whole thing
is
brilliant.
He's great. Great. He's brilliant, man. He's just great. Yeah.
Can you give a little bit of advice on first building your network?
Oh yeah.
And then also auditioning. How to approach that when you just don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So, a lot of people when they're moving to town, I get asked, you know, similar questions, and, mm-hmm. and I'll preface this by saying that I can only tell you what worked for me.
Right.
But a common thing I'll tell guys is, you know, or girls or whatever, is that in this town, in terms of networking, you know, familiarity breeds trust and it goes a long way. And I can't think of the number of opportunities that kind of came my way just from being around and being a consistently like normal, good hang, you know. I was definitely, you know, at points in my life offered opportunities to play guitar that by someone who had never heard me play guitar, but had been around me enough and liked me and thought, yeah, he's cool. Let's just give him a try, you know? And, you know, so when it comes to this idea of networking, for me, I got very, very, very little return from any of, like, from having some sort of really strong agenda in terms of like, well, I'm going to set up a meeting with so-and-so and go in here and talk with them and tell them that I want to be a part of their music and this kind of stuff. And maybe some people have had success doing that. It never really worked for me that way. Mm. For me, I can trace my entire career kind of back to one session and one thing. And it was all just because like I was hanging out with a buddy who was dating this girl and we were all hanging out a lot. And then we started working and I met this guy and then we started hanging out. And then I started going to see these shows and I was just a fan of their shows. And then one week their guitar player couldn't make it. And because they knew me, they had me play guitar. And it literally all just builds like that, like roots from a, you know, a tree just spreading.
It just makes those opportunities more memorable, I feel like.
Yeah. And,
you know,
yeah, completely. And I think you're also too, you're, you know, if you're talking about quote unquote building a brand, mm-hmm. right? Well, what better way can you build it other than just like being the person that people like being around?
Right.
You know, now obviously there's a barrier to entry in terms of a skill set and you have to be good enough to do whatever job. If you're a terrible songwriter, being a cool person is going to get you in the room once and they're going to go, well, they were sweet and all, but let's don't do that again. Same with playing guitar or drums or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I can think of almost, you know, 0.0 times where someone saw me play guitar and came up to me cold and said, hey, you're better than the guy that I have playing guitar for me. Let me hire you instead of him. Never. But however many times that I had people that called me and said, hey man, did I hear you say you played a little mandolin? It's like, yeah, man, come do this gig with me. Cause my guitar player is going to be there, but I need a mandolin player too. And you're, okay, I'll do that. You know? And that kind of stuff. And then that ultimately leads to the second part of this is the audition situation, mm-hmm. which can be tough. You know, I won't lie. It's a strange situation. And most of the time you're marching in there before and after somebody who just auditioned for the same thing. Mm-hmm. But again, things you can control versus things you can't. Okay. So in terms of an audition, the best advice I can give anybody is be prepared, learn the songs they give you for one, which sounds like a no-brainer, but you'd be surprised. Which I circle way back to our conversation about taking it seriously as a job and a profession and not just being a guy that plays music.
Right.
But show up, be professional, be on time, know the songs, and just be kind and engaging to the people in the brief period of time you have there. You know, you'll probably meet an artist or the band leader for 5 minutes and they'll talk to you and just be engaging and show them that you're a normal person and that you're, you know.
And it makes everybody comfortable and yeah. it's tense. It's...
And then all you can do is play the best you can and then walk out and see what happens. Because there's the things you can't control are mm-hmm. things like, well, the drummer also has a buddy that's auditioning, and so he probably is going to ultimately end up getting the gig anyway. Or, you know, or something happens internally as a part of your audition that's maybe not even your fault, but then throws people off. And then, or you're the first person that comes in the morning, and by the end of the day, they might have just kind of forgotten how much they liked you. I mean, you can't control those kinds of things. And so all you can do in terms of these auditions is control what you can control, and that's be prepared, be a cool person, you know, look people in the eye, all that kind of thing.
Right.
You know, it's show up on time and then show them that you're a person that they're going to, if you get the gig, that they're going to want to spend time with because you're going to be on a bus with them
for a very long time, probably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about live performance. Yeah. You were a huge part of our Rewind shows.
Yeah.
The early days.
Yeah. Yeah.
So kind of your place in that, why you feel like it's a value to the community and how musicians can prepare for live gigs, whether they're on a small scale or
sure
large stadium.
Sure. Yeah. Well, live music is that's the basis of everything because, you know, literally, you know, 100 years before there was recorded music, there was symphonic stuff and everything. So it all goes back to live music and live performance. You know, these records that we make, these are catching a moment in time, but they're really just a vessel to go out and connect with people in terms of the live thing. And the shows in town, you know, the Yep shows were great because we did such a diverse, catalog of music over all those different shows, whether it be time periods or specific artists or whatever. And that was kind of fun and challenging as a musician. You know, mm-hmm. all the players, we always liked it because we got to do so much different stuff.
Yeah.
And it was great because I think for a lot of the artists, you know, when I was doing it, I think they probably rarely got the chance to kind of sing some of those songs at that level. You know, it's beyond karaoke, you know?
Yeah.
And then to a crowd and then also for charity and for a good cause and all that kind of stuff. In terms of, you know, shows in town, it's playing these kinds of things, I feel like a broken record, but like just being prepared to show up and do your best and play, you know, I mean, like rehearsals are never a bad thing, people, you know, and if you can't, like absolutely can't get a rehearsal together, like just doing your homework. It's unfortunate sometimes to see someone have a bad showing at a live
right.
you know, show, whether they're an artist or, you know, forgetting words to songs or, you know, just kind of blunders on stage or whatever. And there's things that happen that are out of people's control. And sometimes people just, you know, genuinely have a brain fart. But a big part of me, you know, there was a period of time when after I had left my touring gig full time and I was making ends meet by playing shows like an animal, anyone that was going to pay me $30 or $40 to
right.
come play a show, I would go play a show. And I didn't prepare for those shows any different than I prepared for a show when I was with Josh Turner or prepared mm-hmm. for a show when I go out and do an award show or go play the CMAs or any of that stuff. Now it's like I was preparing in a way that I didn't embarrass myself or anybody else on stage. You know, I wanted to have a good showing. And I think, you know, if everyone kind of looks at it like that, like, well, they just want to represent themselves the best and have a thing, it's like, then everybody gets to rise up and win together, right?
Right.
And then the show is, what a better vessel than that for someone to come away and be blown away by, you know, what you've done. And then they, again, I'm not saying that they're going to come up and go, man, you guys are great, I'm going to quit hiring everybody I've been hiring and use you guys. But makes them want to be around you. They come up and they say, man,
if they see that you're having fun, it's not going to be hard to.
It's contagious. And there's a synergistic aspect of all that. And also I made some great friends, like lifelong friends in the kind of live show scene where mm-hmm. they were playing in different bands and we would always hang out. And have drinks after each other's set and talk and, you know, or whatever. And those friends end up getting you other gigs and you meet, I mean, again, networking, all that stuff. It really does all kind of circle back to the live gigs for sure.
For sure. I came up with a new segment in my car during lunch today. Mm-hmm. Josh doesn't know about it, but it's just called Rewind.
Okay.
Based off of the shows. So I'm going to go through a couple of just quick questions of your first. So first paid gig in the industry.
Oh, it was Tammy Cochran. She had a song called Angels in Waiting.
I think I remember that
song. I went out and that was my first like gig out where I made money. Yeah.
First song you learned on the guitar.
Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple.
Wow.
Which I actually just 2 weeks ago got to make a record with Ian Gilliam, who was the singer from Deep Purple. And I like after like 4 days of holding it in, we were at lunch at Mellow Mushroom and I was just kind of like, Smoke on the Water was the first song I played on guitar. I had to kind of bust out. He was very gracious, but
it's awesome. Yeah. First guitar you bought?
The first guitar I owned, my dad gave to me. So because he's a guitar player, and so I had access to some stuff.
Yeah.
He gave me a Telecaster. The first guitar I bought myself, I still have and use all the time. Was a baritone Dan Electro baritone, because when I started playing for Josh Turner, I needed a baritone guitar. And so I went out and bought one for his tour.
Amazing. Okay. And then first venue you played?
Bailey's downtown. There was a writer's night upstairs at the thing, which is how I got hired to go play the Tammy Cochran gig. I was playing a writer's round.
Like you said, this is all a map.
It's
traced back.
I was playing a writer's round for a girl that I had met waiting tables she wasn't a guitar player, and she was playing a writer's round, and I played the writer's round at Bailey's with her for free. And a guy came up to me at that thing and was like, hey man, we don't know each other. I play for Tammy Cochran. We've got a gig in 2 days. I have called every sub I know and no one can do it. Do you want to do it? And it was probably the only time in my life someone just came up to me and offered me a gig, but that was the start.
That's fantastic. Yeah. And finally, the first time or opportunity, and I don't like to say like where you felt like you'd made it, because I feel like you're always learning career you're in, but where you were in the place that you were like, this is where I want to be. This is like,
yeah, you,
feeling the wheels turn.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I would say I had it, I would say two different times. Definitely when I started playing for Josh Turner, I remember because I had done a few gigs and was making a little money, but I was also still waiting tables. And when I got hired for Josh, he was my first full-time job. And I'd say about 6 months into that job, once I kind of finally had some comfort and knew the guys and they were my friends, there was a moment where I just kind of looked around on the bus one morning and was like, man, this is pretty cool. I'm making money and doing this and this is pretty awesome, you know, and was like, okay, I definitely want to keep doing this, you know. And then I would say the same thing happened years later when I played my first real like publishing company demo session. It was at Station West Studios, and it was at EMI. EMI is not even a publisher anymore, but it was one of their writers. And I remember going in and doing the little 5-song demo session, 10-1, and being done and walking out of there and just feeling like I had been driving a race car for 3 hours.
Isn't that the best feeling ever?
Oh, it was the greatest.
When you know you're on the right track to what you're supposed to be doing.
I was just like, this is what I want to do. Like, just like that. Like, and I remember just thinking like, I want to go do it again right now. Like, I want to go to another session right now. And of course I didn't have another session for like weeks because I was a nobody, but it was definitely like getting that chance to, it was like driving a Ferrari or something for the first, you know, and you go, whoa, I want one of these. And that's how it felt for me. So I'd say I had that twice, luckily.
Well, this has been awesome.
Yeah, it's been great.
I can't wait to share it with everybody that listens. To close out, what do you love about what you do? And is there any other projects that like you're working on right now that you're excited for people to hear about?
The best thing about what I do is the people. Period. Music is great, and I love that I get to play guitar and make music. But the people, the community we have here in Nashville, all the players, all the writers, the producers, the production assistants, the pluggers, the label people, A&R. I mean, there's just so many great people we get to be around and hang around. You know, I'm going to a roast of Shane McAnally here in a minute, you know, and
yes,
it's definitely the people are is the best thing about what I do. And being in kind of earning your way into the community and then being welcomed and feeling like that's a part, is absolutely the best part of what I do.
Well, music's great with having you in it. So thanks, Derek.
Yeah, thank you.
Stay in the loop on latest Yep events by following Yep Nashville and Yep Los Angeles on social media to learn how to get involved in your city. Visit yepnashville.com for newsletter signup, Yep event happenings, and a whole lot more. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Libby Ulrich. And until next time, discover, cultivate, accelerate.